Hey there, I'm Tal Zlotnitsky from Ignite IT Consulting. You know me from the Braving Business podcast, but when I'm not behind the mic, I'm helping tech startups and established companies ignite their full potential. I also help entrepreneurs and businesses in distress reset for success. With over three decades of entrepreneurial success, I bring hands-on experience to drive growth, navigate turnarounds, raise capital, and lead through innovation. Whether it's executive coaching or strategic transformation, I'm here to turn your business challenges into success stories. Visit igniteitconsulting.com and let's spark that change together. That's igniteitconsulting.com. Your journey to business brilliance starts now.
And one last quick thing. If you enjoyed this episode, please stay on after the show to learn more about the Braving Business podcast and other great episodes for you to discover. And now, let's get the show started. Well, hello there.
Hey there, buddy. How are you?
I am well, Mr. Green Jeans. Look at that resplendent green shirt you have on. Very nice.
I know. It's actually Publix. It's a Publix. Publix is a grocery chain in the Southeast, and I'm in Tampa Bay, Florida, as you know, and it's our grocery chain. And I got this shirt from Publix many years ago. I don't wear it often, but it's a nice color.
Wow, they're just handing out the swag. You know, You sent me a picture recently that had you with the shirt off. And I do.
You really are going to go there.
Well, no. All I'm going to say is if I had your physique, I would never own a shirt. So, I'm happy you're wearing one.
I'm sure Dennis looks better without his shirt on. Let's just go there. This is going downhill in a hurry. Dennis, I will tell you, I was on vacation in Jamaica and I shared a photo with PJ of myself having just entered, and I don't know if I'm embarrassed to say or proud to say, but won a pole dancing competition in my resort. And I was shirtless, that is true. And I don't know why PJ decided to share that with our audience, but he did, and we'll just have to roll with that.
So there's the famous Top Gun movie scene of them playing beach volleyball. Were you one of those ripped guys that looked like you were oiled up?
He really was. I will say, you know, he's got the washboard abs, and I would like to say that even though people can clean their clothes on his abs, they can lay them out to dry on mine. So it's
oh goodness. Listen, let's introduce Dennis before I know. We lose our entire audience.
Before everyone loses their lunch. All right. So
that's right.
Dennis, thank you for being here, sir. Dennis Stearns is a financial strategist, a futurist, and an entrepreneur who has built a reputation as one of the leading scenario planners in the world. As the founder of Stearns Financial Group, he has helped clients navigate economic uncertainty and create innovative strategies for success. Named Entrepreneur of the Year and Most Admired CEO, Dennis has been quoted in major outlets like the Wall Street Journal, the New York Times, and Kiplinger Finance. He is also an accomplished author with books like Ninja Entrepreneurs, How Top Business Owners Achieve Success, which is his most recent book, and Fourth Quarter Fumbles, How Successful People Avoid Critical Mistakes in the Last Quarter of Life. Dennis brings a wealth of knowledge from his work as a clean tech venture partner and his unique background as a chess master, where he has learned the art of strategy and adaptability from losing most of the 1,000 games he played with his mentor. His mission is to empower business owners to think ahead, adapt to change, and create sustainable success. Dennis, we are thrilled to have you on the Braving Business podcast.
Well, thank you. Thrilled to be here. Big fan of your show. Listen to it all the time.
Oh my gosh. Well, all right.
It's very kind of you.
You're now my favorite person we've had on.
Already? Jesus, you're so easy to win over.
I am.
Flattery is just so
my God. Yes, please. All day.
Dennis, we're glad to have you on. You're definitely one of the most accomplished thinkers that I think we've had on the podcast. I'm really excited to get your feedback on the future, because the future is so scary to a lot of people. I was having conversations over the weekend with
a friend who is just petrified by what the AI revolution is bringing to the world. And I'd love to get your perspective on that. But we're going to start a little bit closer to the point of origin. You are described as one of the top financial scenario planners in the world. First, maybe help us understand what that means. And then tell us what drew you to that. What made this something that appealed to you as a career choice?
Yeah, well, I was trained early on by some of the best scenario people to think about how the world could materialize in the future and to try to figure out what the variables are and then watch those variables like a hawk and develop pivot strategies and adaptive strategies. And so the concept here is you don't have a official crystal ball, not to mention the guest that you had.
Our last guest. A
couple of shows ago.
Dennis was telling us how hard an act to follow Crystal Ball as our guest a couple of episodes back. And I would encourage you, if you've not listened to that episode, do check that episode out.
But wonderful.
I digress. Go ahead.
Yeah. And so, some of my articles have been around. I don't have a magic crystal ball, but we do think about the future in a more intense way than most. And probably more importantly is figuring out how to move a particular direction if things we see start to happen. And that happens to be the number one most requested chapter to have me talk on in the Ninja Entrepreneur book is Adapt and Pivot. And it was incredible. The 120 companies that we interviewed, the questions they had, and many of these are very successful private companies, about, okay, when do I disrupt myself? When do I do a pivot when it's not an emergency situation? And that's the problem, is most pivots in the private sector are done when somebody's in a crisis or the pandemic hits or something else happens. And so it's really hard to dig your well before you're thirsty and, you know, get ahead of those things that can happen.
That's a great line. dig your well before you're thirsty. You've talked in your work as one of the key themes being this preparing for future challenges. What are some of the most pressing future threats that you see business owners are dealing with today or facing today? And how do you feel that they can prepare?
Well, I think one of the threats that we're doing as part of our Sum of All Fears research is the potential for supply chain snarls to happen again, like they happened in the pandemic. And unfortunately, only about a third of all the supply chain snarls that happened in the pandemic have been permanently fixed. There's still two-thirds out there that people put Band-Aids on. And so the question that we're going through with all of our business owner clients right now is, okay, how's your supply chain? And is it really as secure as you think it might be? And if something unthinkable happens, and what I'm about to describe is probably a 50-50 proposition, so I don't think it's even in the unthinkable category. If China invades Taiwan, think about the second and third order effects of that happening. And what will it do to whatever it is you sell, whether it's a product or a service? And so that's one of the key, dig your well before you're thirsty kind of themes we're working through with people. And the other one is think about your customers. I mean, that was one of the big things that came out of Ninja Entrepreneurs. It's not exactly a state secret that customers have more power than they've ever had before in history of mankind. And they are getting this power through Amazon and a whole bunch of other sources. And they have the ability to be smarter shoppers. And so the question is, have we upped our game as business owners to make sure that we're prepared for smarter shoppers? I mean, it's sort of business 101, stay close to your customers, right? Yeah. Part of our, what we call our super trend research, this collision of these massive trends, is that this is probably going to become a bigger thing as we go.
When you say that customers are more powerful than ever, is it just because they have more options at their fingertips, or can you flesh that a little bit for me?
Yeah, they have more options at their fingertips, and they have the ability to shop for alternatives. And this is a fundamental of economics. You know, it's the reason why when prices go up in the grocery store, people look for alternatives in the grocery store. And so, but the same thing is true whether you're a B2B or B2C type business, is people have a lot of options and alternatives. And, you know, if you're not exceptional in your category, well, you could be vulnerable in this environment that we envision in the next 5 to 10 years.
What's interesting to me, I think, is that the proliferation of generative AI has exponentially increased the power of consumers, because they can so easily search today in ways that are far more powerful than what we felt was fairly powerful already with Google. Now we see what actual personalized search can look like, and it is shifting even more power, I think, to consumers. And I'm curious, and I asked that, or I raised that point early on. You raised supply chain, which is an absolutely very valid concern and risk that businesses should be thinking about. But those businesses are more, I would say, I don't want to use the word traditional, but those who provide goods. What about services? How do you envision, what is the biggest risk that you see to companies and businesses in the services sector?
Yeah, talent is one of the real key areas that we're working with a lot of businesses on right now. And it's no secret that you're only as good as your next employee that you're going to hire, and the ones keeping the ones that you have. I mean, we have almost a full chapter devoted in Ninja to some creative companies who have figured out better ways to attract good people and then keep good people. And this environment we're in, we're still in a reasonably tight labor market. And, you know, we worked with a guy named Chris Zarnick, who is the global head of Vistage, which is the roundtable groups for entrepreneurs, their talent area. And Chris likes to tell the story that we're fighting the last war on talent, that most business owners are still kind of in the mode of, well, people are going to line up because I've got such a good business, or, you know, I'm such a good owner, a good CEO, whatever, and they're going to come to work for us. And it is an absolute, you know, fight out there to get and keep really good talent. And, you know, I do a lot of work also with various universities on teaching young entrepreneurs and growing entrepreneurs. And, you know, that second hire, that fifth hire, that 10th hire, I mean, every one of those is going to take you in a different trajectory on the chessboard. And most of the time, you hire what you can afford. Well, sometimes those aren't the ones that represent the absolute best for you winning the game, ultimately. So this whole talent thing has just become crazy.
Yeah. So one of the things that actually you brought it up, you are a chess master. And so, you know, how has your experience as being a chess master influenced your own strategic thinking in business and as well as financial planning?
Yeah, good question. So when I was first starting out in chess, I was an ADHD kid, and I was driving my sister and brother, both older, absolutely crazy. And so my dad was racking his brain trying to figure out, what can I do with this kid? I mean, if it were today, they'd probably put me on Ritalin or something. And so he got me into chess and tennis, and it was chess that really got me to settle down, focus. And I had a Cuban chess master as an early mentor. Now, if you can imagine him sitting down with little 10-year-old Dennis, and he says, we're going to play 1,000 games. You're going to lose every one of them, but you will learn something from every one. And little 10-year-old me was like, you know, that doesn't sound like much fun. But that which does not kill us makes us stronger. And I mean, he was a tough guy. And what it taught me was, again, you learn from your mistakes. You pivot, you adapt, you study the masters so that you develop kind of that internal software that we all have of what would a master do in this situation. That's why I love shows like yours and the explosion of entrepreneurial podcasts, because it gives you so many things to kind of lock away into that internal software. And then you come up against a situation and you have a little better sense of how to make the right decision on it.
So that's actually a great segue to your new book, which is Ninja Entrepreneurs, How Top Business Owners Achieve Success. And in this book, you talk about the power of adapting and pivoting in the world we're in. And we've talked a little bit about some of the pivot points that specific businesses may face. But can you share a story from your career, particularly in the early stages, and maybe leaning into what you learned from the chess master, the Cuban chess master that beat you 1,000 times, which I love. Is there a story that you can share with us about this principle of adapting and pivoting? Is there a story you could share about that principle in action?
Yeah, well, one of the things that I learned in chess is if you have an option A and an option B, never settle for that. Always look for the third line of play. And the third line of play is the one that is not immediately obvious. And so when we have been working with business owners over decades, that's part of the work that we've done with them is to say, okay, let's look at option A and option B that you're considering, but let's really think hard. Maybe it's A or B, but let's really think hard if there's an option C that has a better risk-reward ratio. And a lot of times that decision-making is influenced by the mentors, the leaders that people have surrounded themselves with. And again, I think entrepreneurs, you know, in the early stages, it's tends to be a little bit of the lone ranger, and you know, you're kind of just making decisions on the fly, and you hope they come out right, and you hope that you make more good decisions than not. I mean, it's like baseball, right? You know, if you could have a pretty good batting average but not do everything right, you're probably going to be pretty successful. And so our belief is that the environment we're coming into is more treacherous. It is more uncharted waters out there. There's opportunities galore, but there's threats galore. And that just means that every business owner just needs to kind of up their game.
Well, I'd love to hear a story of how you actually experienced it on your own terms, right? Early on in your career, what's a story that you can think of where you actually lived this principle yourself?
Yeah, and that's easy because, you know, they look at our firm and they say, oh, you're a multi-billion dollar firm and you have all this capability within your firm. Well, that didn't just arrive overnight. And so in the early stages of building the business, I made some of those same mistakes. I, you know, or maybe I settled for somebody that I could afford as opposed to somebody who would really take me to the next level. One of the things that was really helpful to me was when we were about 10% of our current size, one of our business owner clients sat me down and he said, Dennis, you got to invest ahead of the curve, and you got to invest in really good people if you're going to grow and be a great enterprise someday. He said, do you really want it? And again, that's been a theme on a few of your shows is, you know, do you really want it? And so I thought long and hard about what it meant to try to develop a multi-billion dollar firm. And I really wanted it. And so I went out, and when I had five candidates for a new job, if one of them was 10% more expensive, but really was a quality add-on, I would stretch to make that happen. Sometimes I went without bonuses myself. Again, entrepreneurs do that all the time, right? To be able to build a good team around me. During 08-09 was the Great Recession, was one of the most difficult scenario environments ever, because, you know, late in 08, you had Congress fiddling while Rome burned. They really weren't moving quickly to try to solve the issues that were happening. The whole economy was freezing up. And you opened up the newspaper and there were pictures of 1929. So the predictions were, we're going to a depression worldwide, not a bad recession, but an actual depression. So we're making decisions in our firm. And we had really good people I had hired a decade before who were thoughtful, well-trained. We dug our well before we're thirsty, so the cobbler does have shoes here. And the cobbler's kids have shoes, too. and so, you know, we're still trying to make just really tough decisions. And so we have an extended network of business owners and clients all over the world. We just went out to them and said, what do you see going on? And we weren't just looking for the third line of play. We were looking for the fourth and fifth line of play and trying to figure out, should we be moving everybody, you know, to cash? We had already actually moved a lot to cash and more defensive things, but should we get even more defensive, or should we now lean in and be more offensive minded? One of the toughest decisions in my entire firm, because we were essentially betting the future of the firm. Not that we would have gone out of business if we pivoted the wrong way, but we would not be what we are today. And we were both fortunate. Again, we have one of the top plastics entities in the country, and plastics are in everything. And they said, you know, we're starting to see orders pick up, so we're not so sure this global depression thing's going to happen. Well, that was when the stock market was in its second crater in early 2009. And so on the outside, you said, oh my God, what's going on? But we said, okay, take a deep breath here, and you know, Navy SEAL, four square breathing, and let's try to figure out what's really going on. And from there, we just continued to play the offense and take advantage of the opportunities.
You know, that's kind of you're bringing me back some flashbacks of Tal. I don't know what you were doing during that time, but I've been involved in international supply chain for my entire career. It's like 34 years now. And in 2008, 2009, you know, I had been helping companies do all their imports out of China. And normally ocean freight is very steady from a cost perspective. You could, you know, the floor used to be like $1,400 for a 40-foot container that would move from Pearl River Delta, China, to Long Beach. It's like one of the busiest freight corridors in the world, and something that people could really rely on as a number. That number vanished and just started going down and down and down. And from a freight forwarding standpoint, we didn't understand it, and we were seeing that the competition for ocean lines in Asia were just basically killing themselves, thinking that they were losing volume to their competitors. So they kept lowering their rates, and it was just this race to the bottom. And that's when we realize, oh, this is a big deal. this is a terrifying prospect that's going on. So I get it. Like everything that you're saying is you know, destroying years of therapy that I've had. So thanks a lot, Dennis.
Sorry for giving you the flashback.
it was a rough time. So
if I could jump ahead. In, PJ, because I think you're raising a couple of interesting points that I think are worth fleshing out a little bit more, which is in moments of crisis, you tend to assume that the playbook you should be calling plays from is a traditional playbook. Mm-hmm. So there were a bunch of companies there who assumed that what was happening was they were losing business to competitors as opposed to recognizing, no, something fundamental has shifted and the old playbook's not going to work. And I think this really fits in with Dennis's very point around you need to be thinking not merely in the context of what threats have I seen, but what are the future threats that I haven't seen and what might I do, right? That's the whole concept, I think, of dig the well before you're thirsty. If I'm following the logic there, Dennis, does that resonate for you?
Yeah, you're spot on. It's a messy world anyway, and sometimes it gets more messy than many of us would like.
Yeah, it was. There was a lot of lessons learned there. You were probably way ahead of it, but we learned the hard way. Lots of bumps.
I had just in 2008, 2009, I had just sold my first company and I started another and had the incredible fortune of speaking on behalf of President Obama to the White House press on the West Lawn of the White House at the age of 33.
Nice.
Nice.
And that is what I recall from that time frame. I know a lot of people have horrible, nightmarish memories. That is what I recall from that time in my life. Maybe the highlight of my life. I mean, now followed closely by winning the pole dancing competition in Jamaica, of course.
Well, one day I hope to have the same amount of accolades as you do, Tal. So Dennis, you have surrounded yourself, or you've said that surrounding yourself with the right people has been a key to overcoming adversity. And absolutely, I don't think there's a person in the world who would argue against that. It's an obvious and true statement. The big struggle is how to identify those people when perhaps you don't have a lot of experience building or assembling a team. So what advice would you have for those burgeoning entrepreneurs trying to build a resilient team on what the key qualities are to look for and the shiny object qualities to look past?
Really good question. And, you know, the traditional advice is to hire slow and fire fast. Unfortunately, a lot of entrepreneurs, because they have an immediate need to fill, they actually reverse
that. Guilty as charged.
Yeah. And so one of the things that any small growing business, like we have a small growing business that we're mentoring in Raleigh, and they have tremendous growth potential in the future, and they're up against some big competitors, and they're hiring ahead of the curve, trying to grow their business fast, is let's have a team that will assess and evaluate these potential team members. And it's a bit of an unconventional team. You know, some of them are the folks from the firm themselves who meet with the individual. Some of them are outside mentors, which can include me, who will come at it from a completely different way of vetting somebody. Sometimes it's just doing what you actually need to do, which is really get down in the weeds with somebody and try to ask them a whole lot of questions about how they would deal with this situation or that situation. You know, a lot of people are very good interviewers. That's the problem. And they will pull the wool over your eyes. And I've had a number of those myself that I thought, oh, this is just the right person. But I contained my enthusiasm and I stuck with my discipline of having others kind of take a look at somebody. And I avoided some massive hiring mistakes by doing that. So, you know, they don't have to be a Harvard MBA or, you know, whatever. Just it's people you know who have good common sense who can, you know, spot a BSer is helpful.
So how do you spot a BSer? I mean, I don't disagree with you. I think the question PJ asked is the right question, right? It's not a matter of, is there any doubt at all that the caliber of people you surround yourself with is going to impact your level of success? None whatsoever. I don't think there's anybody that's listened to this podcast who's an entrepreneur or frankly alive who would not acknowledge that the quality of the people around you have, if not the most dominant, a very, very substantial impact on how successful you are. Obviously, your product matters, pricing, et cetera, et cetera. People matter most. The biggest challenge is spotting the BSer. That's the biggest challenge. I've struggled with that my entire career. I'm a person who tends to assume the best, okay? What's one thing or two things, if that comes to mind? I'd love that if you had an opportunity to point to one thing that you've learned in years and years of doing this that is a red flag for a likely BSer. I have one I want to share, but I want to hear your answer first.
Yeah, well, one of my favorites is to ask a prospective employee, what's the biggest mistake you've made in your working life, and what did you learn from it, and how did you fix it? And usually, people have multiple answers to that question. The person who says, oh, well, you know, one time I forgot to put something down on my timesheet, you know, is probably lying to you. And so, you know, one of the things also that I have found is that sometimes opposite sets can detect things. And, you know, so if I'm interviewing a man, I want one of the people on my team or my extended team outside my company, I want a woman to be able to ask some of the questions, because they may get entirely different answers. They'll go down different bunny paths, and they will eventually find out that something's not quite right. Now, the other piece that we have found extremely valuable, you know, calling references, always a challenge, right? Because no reference, first of all, if they're going to give you a reference, it's probably somebody good. And then is the reference going to actually say anything bad? We have been surprised when we ask those same questions. Well, what's the most awkward situation, John, that you found that Bob was in with you, personal or in a business setting? You know, and just ask those open-ended type of questions and get them talking. And eventually, if there's some kind of smoke or fire there, that you're probably going to get a sense of it. You know, we do all the traditional assessments and run them through the gallery of assessments. And some of those assessments have a pretty reasonable BS meter associated with them. But my goodness, I have run into some people who can fool an assessment. And so anyway.
So let me ask you a couple of very specific things that I've been doing, and non-scientific. I have not read them. It's just something that has occurred to me over the years that I've started to do. And I'd love your reaction to them. So the first thing I do is I say something that I know to be false, and I try to assess how that person deals with it. It's something that they should know based on what they're being interviewed for. I'll say something that's false, and I'll evaluate, are they capable of, without offending, pointing it out? Or are they just, because I'm the interviewer, if I say something false, are they just going to let it go? Because as I bring people into senior positions in particular, I want them to be able to feel comfortable enough speaking the truth. And if getting the job is more important than being in an environment where speaking the truth is what the person is seeking, I'm not sure I want them on my team. Can you react to that? I have one more.
Oh, brilliant. So can you give us an example?
I mean, I can give you dozens. It really depends on the job, right? So if I'm interviewing an engineer, I might misstate something about a process that they should know about. And I'll say, well, that my experience is that is how you do it. What's yours, right? So I'm giving them a chance. It's not a matter of they'll need to say to me, no, you're wrong. to chance them to say, well, that hasn't been my experience, or I've when I've done it, it's been this way, right? So I invite them to engage with me on a statement or fact that I'm making. So that's one thing.
Oh,
the
like
other,
it.
Yeah. Well, great. Yeah. Add it to your repertoire. Maybe it'll be in your next book. Then the other.
There you go. And this is in Ninja Entrepreneurs. One of the most challenging people to hire for are salespeople, because they have naturally learned how to BS and pull one over on you.
That's exactly right. So that goes to my second consistent approach, which is I ask questions to which the proper answer is I don't know, and I will hire someone that says I don't know 10 times out of 10 ahead of someone that has an answer to every single question, because in my experience, that is an indication of a bullshit artist. What's your perspective on that?
Again, that just gets right back to being able to have a good conversation with somebody where you're maybe throwing in some zingers, but maybe they don't know they're zingers, and just seeing how they react to them. I love it, because the old thing, the old traditional thing was you take somebody to dinner and you see if they let down their guard after a couple glasses of wine or something else, which, by the way, that still works pretty well. but I think, again, you just got to be, as you were just talking about, you got to be more creative.
That's all great. And to validate, Dennis, what you said about salespeople being bullshit artists, we are. So thank you very much. That's how we survive.
I'll tell you what, it's interesting, PJ, is that the older I get, the more I realize that I am a more successful salesperson when I'm vulnerable and I admit I don't know.
Yeah.
And it took me years and years and years to realize that, because when I was younger, for two reasons. One is that the imposter syndrome rages when you're young. It never goes away completely, but it rages when you're young, right? And so you're really, really struggling to show any kind of vulnerability. Secondarily, it feels like, you may never have another chance, right? You're always, when you're younger, you're always at this place where you're like, well, this better be, I better get this one, because they're, and I've learned that's never the case. There's always another apple to take a bite in. And no one situation warrants you compromising your values and your integrity. Again, learn from years of trial and error and choosing plenty paths in my earlier years where I didn't view it that way.
Well, and it occurs to me, you guys have talked in a lot of your previous podcasts about emotional intelligence, mm-hmm. EQ. And we absolutely agree with you that we believe EQ trumps IQ every day of the week. There's some jobs you have to have a minimum IQ just to do the job. But EQ is such a higher predictor of people rising to success as an entrepreneur. I mean, it's to the point where we are now in several universities including classes on EQ, because I think it's that critical a skill set. And one of my first books, CEO Road Rules, my co-author, she was an expert on teaching EQ. EQ can be learned, which is a fabulous thing, because in our firm, we actually have training programs around EQ, how to sharpen that axe. Well, the sharper the axe you have in EQ, the better chance you can detect somebody who's not authentic.
I could totally see that. Actually, we were just talking about EQ with our last guest, Markel Russell. He was off the charts from us meeting with him and talking with him and seeing how he interacts with people and how he looks at things. His EQ was phenomenal, right? Like really,
I would agree. And this is a guy who Markel dropped out of high school and after the ninth grade.
Yeah.
And his EQ was like something I'd never seen. I mean, it was stratospheric.
Yeah.
It's an episode I'd encourage anyone in the audience who's interested in the concept of EQ to really listen. He shared a lot of pearls of wisdom about his process, which I think would be very valuable to listeners.
Yeah, no, fascinating guy. Fascinating. So, Dennis, you wrote a book previously called The Fourth Quarter Fumbles, about mistakes where people make late in their careers. So what are some of the most common mistakes you see business owners making when they're planning for the fourth quarter? And what can we, I'm in that, what can we do to avoid them?
Yeah, well, the aging of America and the world, you know, more and more people are going to live longer, although we all know examples of people who die too young. But the general trend is going to be live longer. And so in that, there are three segments that we identified back when we were doing that research. And we live this every day because of a lot of the clients that we're dealing with. It's the go-go, slow-go, and no-go stage. And so what's happened in the last couple of decades is the go-go has extended considerably. In the good old days, you got to age 65 and they gave you a gold watch, or if you were an entrepreneur, you know, maybe you had a party or something. And you basically, within 7 years of retiring, either you or your spouse got sick. And if usually it was the guy who got sick, and then the wife became the caregiver, or the partner became the caregiver. And so usually one person was dead within a decade of retiring. Well, not that that doesn't happen today, but in a lot of cases, people are now, I mean, we have clients in their 80s who are bicycling across Croatia with their grandchildren, and all kinds of other crazy stuff that never used to happen in the past. And so as opposed to kind of this slow, gradual decline into being decrepit, you now have an opportunity, not a God-given right, but you have an opportunity, if you take care of yourself, to be able to go deep into the fourth quarter and then drop off a cliff, which, you know, is kind of what we all would like to do, right? You know, die in our sleep, but hopefully after we just had something really fun go on. And so the I think PJ just got that.
Oh yeah.
So
I got it too. Hey, listen to the crystal ball episode where I asked her how she decompresses, and that would be the feeder to that one. Go on.
I thought that was hilarious. And
great answer, huh? Never gotten that one before.
Good job. Good job on that one, by the way. So the you know, the basis of the fourth quarter stuff is that if you're a business owner, we also did a workbook called Fourth Quarter Fumbles for Business and Fourth Quarter Champions for Business. And the issue is that entrepreneurs love what they're doing. I love what I'm doing. And you tend to go deeper into the fourth quarter in a work vein. And a lot of times the reason is not the right reason. The reason is that you can't imagine yourself doing anything else, and you view yourself as being miserable or possibly dying early if you retire. And so what tends to happen is business owners stay longer than all their leadership team would prefer they stay. And what happens then? Well, in this environment, I go out and poach those people. So we have companies that I'm also a partner in, a number of different companies. And if we see a leadership team and we meet one of them, and oh yeah, the owner was supposed to retire 5 years ago, but he's still in there, and I'm not sure what I'm going to do because I was supposed to move up. Well, that person is probably poachable. And so there's a whole bunch of business fumbles that can come with kind of overstaying the welcome. And one of the key things we believe in is, you know, let's try to figure out what the next chapter can look like. You know, maybe it's not exactly the last chapter, but there's a lot of things you can do out there that'll, you know, make you jump out of bed in the morning.
I think it's so interesting that you're bringing this up. I quite literally this weekend had a conversation with a friend who works for a firm. I won't state the industry, where one of the founders is just hanging on and has long lost his edge, is now disruptive. To the point where if he's in a meeting, there is an expectation that 20 to 30% of the time will be wasted chasing rabbits or going down rabbit holes. And she expressed the extent to which that was frustrating, not just to her and the team, but also the clients, which sometimes are privy to that. The challenge, of course, is, you know, at some point that person was probably exceptionally competent and capable. And it's really hard to recognize that you've lost your edge. And if you're in an environment where sharing that truth is going to cost someone their jobs, then you're likely not going to get the input that you need as an entrepreneur, that maybe it's time for you to shift or pivot, even within your company, to some other role. I've seen entrepreneurs do this exceptionally well. I've seen entrepreneurs ruin their companies by not doing it well. And what I'm hearing you say is that, you know, that fourth quarter, if you're just going to be one of those guys, and we've seen them, you know, I don't know if you're a football fan, but we saw Aaron Rodgers yesterday throw touchdown 501. Okay. But boy, have his last couple of seasons tarnished an otherwise stellar career. People stay on too long. This, we've seen it in sports, and we recognize it more easily in sports because you can more readily, because it's a statistical game, you can see their degradation in quality much more readily than you would in a boardroom. But what would you recommend if you're working for someone who's lost, you know, some of their game?
Oh,
what would you recommend to that person other than leaving? Maybe that's the only option, but is there anything besides that that you could share?
Yeah, we have that situation happening right now. And the number two person, you know, his first inclination was, okay, maybe this isn't going to work out, even though I'm very loyal. I've invested a lot of my time and a lot of my effort in making this company better, but it's clear that I'm not going to get my shot. And I said, okay, let's think about a third line of play here. Let's think about another way to approach this. And so we ended up having conversations. He hired a group to come in and do interviews with all the leadership team, and it was ostensibly to be able to make the leadership team work better together in the future. They're under a system called Entrepreneurial Operating System, EOS, and so they had had some issues with the visionary integrator, which has happened a lot, by the way, where those two are too far apart from each other. And so there was some good reasons why they needed to do this evaluation. Well, we encouraged them to include external sources, including family members outside of the company, and the spouse in particular of the owner, to be able to get a true 360-degree view. And so I think that is moving things, because now the business owner is beginning to realize that, hey, maybe I am creating a miserable situation for a lot of people around me. But if you're already on the warning track to any kind of early dementia, you know, the eight warning symbols, if you have two or three of those eight, you're in a path to a really difficult situation, because that individual won't usually recognize it, and it'll be some kind of forced situation that usually turns into legal battles and a war. So, again, we try to, our battle cry is plan ahead, play smart. And so, which I guess is another offshoot of dig your well before you're thirsty. And So a lot of times we suggest that if you get off the track of whatever's been promised to you, if you're a number two person or number three person in a firm, if you get off that track, don't wait even 6 months to bring it to people's attention, bring the situation up, see if there's a way it can be resolved.
Wow. All right. That I never thought we were going to be talking about this today, but that's thank you for that. That's very insightful and terrifying. I'm going to need to look up what those eight signs
are. Are you worried about your own decline?
That's what I was thinking about. I was like, man, I was going to make the joke that I wanted to work with Dennis because all I ever wanted to do was ride my Harley straight into my grave, penniless and a little drunk. But, you know, now he's got me thinking about other stuff. So
there was a great book written on that, by the way, called Die Broke, you know, where your check to the funeral director bounces.
I'm sure the funeral director industry would not appreciate that.
Yeah, really. Oh, that's amazing. All right. So last question, Dennis, you've just been a stellar guest and just a trove of information. So thank you for sharing your time with us. One of the things that you also do is you're a partner in Triad Growth Partners, which is focused on clean tech and water remediation technologies, but also dealing with PAFS, P-A-F-S, which is a tooth crunching acronym for the often toxic man-made chemicals and widely used in packaging, cookware, fabrics, cosmetics, electronics, medical devices, and more. Why have you chosen to focus your time and attention there? And what do you believe is possible to achieve there in the next 5 to 10 years?
Oh, great question. Well, so that came out of a economic development program out of our nanotechnology center, which at the time I was serving on the board and secretary treasurer of and head of strategic planning. And by the way, nanotech is coming. It's going to be here.
There is.
We developed a venture entity. Our first customer was NASA, of all people. And then this gets back to that issue of you hire smart people and they will take you in good and unexpected directions at times. So our chief scientist, she actually got her chops at Carolina and Duke in environmental remediation. And so as we were working on all kinds of contracts to develop research around different things for the future, she kept coming back to this PFAS issue as being the billion and maybe even trillion dollar problem of our time. All the little crap that's in water that we don't even know about. I mean, I actually know more about water problems than I want to know at this stage. And so we ended up getting contracts from Army Corps of Engineers and Air Force and a whole variety of entities to work on researching this stuff. And we're just in the process of launching a major division to actually get out and solve the problem. And it's a cool thing to solve a problem, but I can tell you this was a long game. I mean, this was not Bobby Fischer chess where, you know, it was bing, bang, boom, checkmate. This was the long game, the patient game. But that's how I got involved with that whole area. And, you know, I do a lot with venture capital. We're partners with a venture firm in LA and Singapore in healthcare. And that's another area I'm very passionate about because I think the innovation in healthcare, it's going to be huge because the healthcare system has got major problems.
Oh, it does.
So our guest today was Dennis Stearns, or is Dennis Stearns. He's a one of the world's most well-known and most respected financial strategists and futurists. He has built an incredible company, Stearns Financial Group. And he shared a lot of wisdom with us today. I'd like to thank you for, first of all, for being a listener. We really appreciate that. And I'm extremely humbled. And I appreciate you taking time to talk to us today. In general, I think that, you know, the most useful thing for entrepreneurs, or aspiring entrepreneurs to do is to absorb as much information as possible and then use that information through the prism of their own experiences and their own perspective. So I think one of the interesting things about you as a guest is that there was a lot of talk about the benefits of planning and thinking ahead. And while everyone recognizes that on some level, right, we all know that if we plan ahead, we're going to do better. It's amazing how many people just don't do that. And entrepreneurs maybe are worse than many for some reason in flying by the seat of their pants. And I'll tell you what, you're going to fly yourself, you're more likely to fly yourself into a wall than you are to fly yourself into the clear blue sky. And if there's anything that you heard today that, you know, resonates, it's this brilliant concept of, you know, dig your well before you're thirsty. What a brilliant and simple analogy to think about, because it makes so much sense. So Dennis, it's been a privilege. I really appreciate you taking time to be with us today. Continued success to you. We'd love to maybe give away a couple of copies of Ninja Entrepreneurs, if that's something you'd be open to doing. We can ask our listeners to just write in and tell us why they should win the book. It can be funny. You can be creative. If that works for you, Dennis, maybe we can give away a couple of signed copies. How does that sound?
Oh, that'd be great. And again, guys, I view you as being a cornerstone of why entrepreneurism will flourish going forward. So keep up the good work.
Aw, go you, on, sir. Dennis. Go on. I mean, like, seriously, go on. Keep going. No, and that's a wrap, folks. Like what you heard, want to support the show? Please follow our page on LinkedIn and Facebook. Visit us on YouTube. And please like and rate us on all of your favorite podcast streaming services. You can also see exclusive content, subscribe for free to our weekly blog, support our sponsors, and soon buy our merchandise at www.bravingbusiness.com. Thanks for being a part of our production, and we'll see you next time on the Braving Business Podcast.